It's really with huge pleasure that we welcome David Stasavage, I say back to the LSE, since he taught here when he was a young man. No.
All the students were 10 years younger.
That's right. When all you lot were 10 years younger. That's exactly right. Very good. Yes. I think he's one of the two or three leading political scientists of his generation. So we're really, really lucky that he's come to talk to us. He has an amazing ability to blend history with political science, and he's really pushed the way in which many, many political scientists now take history as something which is a normal activity for political scientists to do. It didn't used to be. The book he's going to talk about, taxing the rich with Ken Sheevey, is the third book he's written. They've all have a really great balance of history and political science in them. His other two books are really on the key origins or changing moments in the building of European states, European polities. And the previous book he wrote, which has been hugely successful, on states of credit, is really almost the sort of classical picture of how states, European nation states, developed as states which could raise credit, and how they did it. He also has a great range beyond that. He wrote what I think is probably the most cited paper on education and democracy in Africa. He also wrote another greatly cited paper on central bank independence. So he is someone who can take a really broad view of things. And David,
thank you.
Over to you.
Okay, thank you, David. Okay, thank you very much for the kind introduction and for the International Inequalities Institute inviting me out, and for all of you attending here tonight. This is a book that was published last spring that Ken Sheevey, my collaborator, and I wrote. It is a book about taxing the rich, and it's a book that's a little bit different in style from some of the pieces that you may see written on this topic. When you see an article or a book, many times people will take a very strong position, even a polemical position, in favor of greater taxes on the rich or in opposition to taxes on the rich. What we've tried to do in this book is take a different tack. We say that, well, given that the issue of taxing the rich is really a fundamental question in a democratic society and in a fundamental question in countries like the US and the UK today and elsewhere, what can history tell us about when and why governments actually tax the rich? And to do this, we've constructed a lot of data on 20 countries over 200 years. And so most of what I'm going to show you tonight is going to be based on this broad picture. And the idea is that if we want to understand things about taxing the rich, when it happens and when it doesn't, then let's go to the broad sweep of history. Let's not look at the sort of micropolitics of what's happening in the UK or the US today. Let's think about some broad themes. And this is the picture, which is the one thing that's probably the most important for setting the background for this book. This is a collection of average top marginal tax rates over the last 200 years, for the 20 countries in our sample, of countries mostly Western European, North American, and a few from elsewhere. And what you see in this picture is a very striking pattern. You'll see a striking pattern whereby top rates of income taxation or inheritance taxation were extremely low for the 19th century, extremely low, in fact, up until 1914. Then there was a sudden increase in average top rates across countries, both in income taxation and inheritance taxation, and that what's happened over the past 40 years or so has been a march away from those very high top rates that we saw in the 1950s and 1960s and into the 1970s. And so the big question for the book then is, how can we explain this picture over time, and can helping us explain this picture say something about debates about taxing the rich today? This is a second picture, which I think is also useful to show, because it shows that if you think about it, the decline in terms of top tax rates on the rich has actually been greater when you take into account the fact that the size of government has grown very considerably since the beginning of the 20th century. So if the size of government has grown very considerably and the rich are actually paying less, that means that everybody else is paying relatively more. So there are major questions then. This only sort of deepens the mystery about why there's been such a drastic decline and why there was such a big increase in taxes on the rich in the beginning. Well, there are some received explanations out there that you might think of in terms of what drove these top tax rates. One of them, if you're thinking about the turn of the 20th century, might be the advent of electoral democracy, establishment of male universal suffrage, or even universal suffrage for both sexes, the rise of political parties, social democratic and socialist and labor parties seeking to mobilize working class groups. Maybe that was the real impetus for that increase in top tax rates that we saw circa 1914 and afterwards. We're going to suggest, and I'll show you some further evidence, that in fact the influence of electoral democracy on its own was relatively small. The second thing we might ask is, what has been the effect of trends in inequality? When people in the US in particular today look at recent trends in inequality and they say, well, we know from the work of Thomas Piketty and others that top income shares have grown drastically over the past 30 or 40 years, and yet there's been a movement away from taxing the rich. How can we explain that? Maybe the US today, or even the UK today, is something of an anomaly. Maybe over 20 countries, over 200 years, we'd actually see that when inequality goes up, governments tax the rich more heavily. That doesn't happen. I'll discuss this in greater detail, but policy on average across these 20 countries over 200 years does not respond to rising inequality. So there's no reason that we should think that rising inequality on its own is going to generate the political impetus for greater taxes on the rich. What we do suggest in this book is that if we want to understand when and why and how governments tax the rich, then we have to look into beliefs about different standards of fairness and taxation and how they've changed over time in response to outside events, chiefly participation in the two world wars, but not only participation in the two world wars. And when we say something about tax fairness, one of the most important points we try to make in this book, and I hope it's a lesson that I'll convince you of tonight, is that there are different criteria for tax fairness. Different people hold different criteria for tax fairness. There's not one set criterion that all or even a majority of individuals would adhere to. People will probably all agree that a tax system should be fair, but that's about all they would agree on. Once we go beyond that statement, then you need to think about what fair means. Well, one fair argument, one criterion for tax fairness is what we call in the book equal treatment. This is an argument that's been around since the advent of republics, at least modern republics, in 16th century Florence. There's an argument that has been made time and time again by opponents of progressive taxation, of opponents of taxing the rich at higher rates than everybody else, who say that if you're in a democracy or a republic, then because everybody has one vote that should, in theory at least, count the same, then it seems logical that everybody should pay the same tax rate. There's a certain resonance there. We're not deriving that argument from any sort of axiomatic principle. We're just saying that this is an argument that has been made time and time again. And it's a standard that we see in our surveys for the U.S. electorate that people seem to respond to. They will come up when you provide them with a survey and you say, should we tax everybody at the same rate or tax the rich more heavily? And then you offer them the opportunity to say why, for example, they chose a flat tax rate. They'll say, well, no, it's a democracy. Everybody has one vote. Everybody should pay the same tax rate. This is a fundamental argument of tax fairness against taxing the rich more heavily than everybody else. The most common argument made over, again, the last 500 years, and this goes back to 16th century Florence as well, is that the rich should be taxed at higher rates than everybody else because what we want to do is not equalize how much they pay or the rate they pay. We want to equalize the sacrifice that each person makes. And so because £1,000 for a rich person is less of a sacrifice than £1,000 for a poor person, then what we ought to be doing is having the rich pay a higher rate because they can better afford it. This is at the fundamental principle of, if you think about it, modern either welfare economics would suggest that this should be a principle that should be applied, or other normative views in economics textbooks about when the rich should be taxed at higher rates. So it's a fundamental, it's the most commonly used argument for taxing the rich on fairness grounds. There's also a third type of argument that we see over the last two centuries, and this is what we call compensatory arguments. A compensatory argument says we shouldn't tax the rich more because they have more. We should tax the rich more because they've done less. And what I mean by that is that if the state has asked everybody else to sacrifice in a way that for some reason, the rich are more likely to have been exempted or to have had special privileges, then what we should do then is tax the rich more heavily in order to compensate, in order to, in a sense, restore that baseline of equal treatment. What I'll show or what I'll suggest to you is that these compensatory arguments have been among the most powerful arguments in favor of, politically powerful arguments in favor of taxing the rich, and they've had greatest salience during times of mass mobilization for war. Okay, in what remains, I'm going to take you through four parts to this talk. In the first part, I'll talk about progressive taxation and how it evolved up to 1914. Then I'll talk about the era of mass warfare and taxes on the rich. Then I'll try to explain what happened with the decline in taxes on the rich over the last 40 years or so. And then finally, in the final section, I'll take us back to today's debates and try to suggest what our conclusions in this book might suggest about debates about taxing the rich in the U.S. and the U.K. today or in other countries as well. If we go to the 19th century background for taxing the rich, as you could have guessed from that initial graph I showed, there wasn't much in terms of progressive taxation or taxation of the rich. Income taxation was non-existent for much of the century, with the notable exception of the U.K. during and for a time after the Napoleonic Wars, and then after the 1840s. But if you talk about most of the countries in Western Europe or elsewhere, debates about income taxes and a progressive tax where the rich might pay a higher rate on their income than everybody else really began after the revolutions of 1848 in Europe, where you see the first serious proposals to think, well, maybe we should actually have a progressive tax of maybe 30% on the top earners or maybe 50% on the top earners. So what it resulted was that a number of countries did implement income taxes during the 19th century, in the late part of it, and they implemented progressive income taxes, where the rich paid higher rates than everybody else. And so, as I referred to before, one of the things you might want to know is, was this driven by democratization? Was this driven by the expansion of the suffrage so that all adult males could vote, and even in some countries, men and women? Was it driven by the mobilization of new types of political parties, mobilizing the working class? Our evidence suggests that electoral democracy on its own, didn't really do that much. It didn't produce high top rates. This is a graph that should have probably been better labeled, but I can explain it. And what it is, it's a graph of the top marginal rate of income taxation individually in each of our sample countries. And then what we did was we looked at each of these countries at the time that they established male universal suffrage, which we'll call year zero, and then looked forward 10 years and looked what was happening prior to universal suffrage 10 years before. The black line gives you a look at what the average was across these countries. if universal suffrage had a major effect, we'd expect a shift upwards, or at least a shift in the trend upwards following that, and we really don't. The thin gray lines are the pictures for individual countries in our sample. Even if you go to the individual country lines, you really can't see that much. It's hard to find an individual case where universal suffrage on its own generated a large increase in top tax rates. So it doesn't seem like a political story that simply emphasizes electoral democracy and perhaps the fact that the poor outnumber the rich and therefore they should vote to tax the rich more heavily doesn't seem to get us what we need to explain. That wasn't doing it. So, what arguments were being made in the political arena? There were arguments that were not fairness-based, that simply said we should tax the rich because we're more numerous, but there were also fairness arguments that were being made in the late 19th century. Many supporters justified these new progressive income taxes based on the logic of ability to pay, that I already said, the rich should pay more because they can better afford it. Others made a compensatory argument of the following form. And this is something that Robert Peel made in the Commons in his successful attempt to reintroduce the income tax in the 1840s. What Peel said was, what we need is a progressive income tax, or at least an income tax, because that is going to compensate for the regressive weight of indirect taxes, taxes on common consumption goods that were borne mostly by the lower and the working classes, because the lower and working classes would consume a larger fraction of their income, whereas the rich would consume a smaller fraction of their income. And so, therefore, this was a 19th century style compensatory argument for taxing the rich, or for beginning to tax the rich. What was the end result of this? Some change. By 1914, the average top income tax rate across our countries was 5%. That's up from about 0 or 1% prior to that. But still, a number of our countries in our sample had no income tax at all. And it's important to recognize, this is a really stunning fact, or at least if you're interested in taxes, it is, that in 1914, the top marginal rate of income taxation, the highest one you could find anywhere in Europe, was only 11%, and that was in Norway. And so it was really a fundamentally different era from what we would see subsequently. And so for the 19th century, the story is we think these fairness arguments mattered to some extent, these compensatory arguments about outweighing, using some income taxation to outweigh regressive consumption taxes had some effect, but the end result wasn't all that big. It wasn't the big part of the story. Okay, what happened next? This is probably the second most important graph in the book after the first one, which showed you the whole progress over 200 years. This is a distinction from 1900 to 1930, again, which could have been better labeled, that's showing the top marginal rate of income taxation in our sample of countries, where we break it down between two groups. Countries that mobilized heavily for the First World War and countries that didn't mobilize heavily for the First World War. And what you see in the non-mobilization countries, there is a gentle trend upwards, but it only gets you to about 20% by the 1920s, whereas in the mobilization countries, there's a really dramatic increase in top tax rates, on average taking them up to 50% by the early 1920s, on average. So that's a really astonishing and dramatic change compared to where everybody was in 1914. It's the sort of top tax rates that only radicals had talked about in the 1848 revolutions as being that high. It didn't occur up until 1914, and suddenly it happened. Okay, so one thing you might immediately say is that if there's a distinction between some countries participating in a war and other countries not participating in a war, well, maybe they had to get the money, and this was an unprecedentedly large expense. And so as a result of that, it was just natural that the rich were going to get taxed more heavily in the mobilization countries. Well, there's two responses to this. One is that, in fact, there had been expensive wars prior to World War I where the rich were not taxed more heavily. But then there's also a more interesting twist to this story, and that is that the war effect was present only in democratic countries that mobilized for war. It was not present in any of the non-democracies, either on the Axis side or elsewhere, that mobilized for World War I. So this graph is very similar to the one I just showed you. It's looking at the top marginal rate of income taxation, but now splitting it between two groups. This is the average for all the countries that mobilized for World War I that were democracies, and this is the average for all the countries that mobilized for World War I that were non-democracies. So to us, this graph is a very simple way of showing that there had to be something going on other than just the simple fact that you needed money, and therefore you're going to tax the rich more heavily. For some reason, the democracies tended to do it more, and we're going to suggest that it had to do something about the fact that they were democracies, and that if you're in a democracy, that implies that certain arguments about fairness can be made, about treating people equally, in a way that is more difficult to make in a non-democratic context. So the war effect was larger in the democracies. What was this argument? This is a statement from the Trades Unions Congress from 1916 that sums it up. As the manhood of the nation has been conscripted to resist foreign aggression, this Congress demands that such a proportion of the accumulated wealth of the country shall be immediately conscripted. So the simple idea here is that if you're conscripting labor, then you also ought to be conscripting wealth. This was made in a slightly more detailed fashion by some people by saying, well, we know that there's a conscription limit for the conscription age of 45 in the First World War. We know that older people on average have more wealth. Therefore, fairness would dictate that we should have a compensatory argument for taxing the rich based on the fact that they're not having their labor conscripted. This was an argument, I think it was originally made by the TUC, but it was quickly made in other Labor Party publications. In fact, the co-founder of the LSE, Sidney Webb, was very prominent in making this argument that there should be a conscription of wealth. And I think the reason, the obvious reason for this was, first of all, they believed it, but second of all, this became a very potent political weapon. This was a very catchy and penetrating and simple argument for saying why you should have progressive taxation with really high top tax rates on the rich. It's a compensatory argument, and it's an argument that found its way certainly into speeches. You can look at the U.S. Congress. You can look at debates in Canada, in Australia, in France, in other countries. The U.K. is a prime example of the phenomenon of this fairness argument, compensatory argument being made for conscripting wealth, but it wasn't unique to the UK. It was something that was made more generally. We can provide you with some slightly more systematic evidence for this. This is an exercise we did where we went back to speeches made in the House of Commons during two periods. The first is labeled before World War I began here, is at the time of the debates over the people's budget in 1909. And what sort of income tax should be established, and what sort of rate should be established. The second was after World War I began. On the right-hand side of this panel, all speeches in the Commons made that referring to the income tax, and what sort of arguments were made. We went through with a set of research assistants and said, let's code each of these hundreds of speeches, and let's see what type of arguments were made for or against taxing the rich more heavily than everybody else. In the People's Budget era, prior to World War I, what we see is that many people subscribed to an equal treatment view. Everyone who was, for the most part, who was trying to defend taxing the rich more heavily, progressive taxation, used an ability to pay argument, saying the rich should pay more because they can better afford it. And there were only a few compensatory arguments that were made. It didn't really come into the picture that heavily. What happened, if you look at debates in the Commons after that point, well, there's a dramatic shift away. There are very few people making the old school equal treatment argument. There are some, but fewer people making the ability to pay argument. And there's a huge number of people supporting heavier taxation of the rich based on this compensatory argument for conscripting wealth. So the external conditions had changed. The UK was in a war of mass mobilization instead of at relative peace as it was in 1909. The consequence was that as the external environment changed, the type of fairness-based arguments that could be made changed, and so a lot of prior supporters of taxing the rich shifted over to making compensatory arguments, and even a lot of prior opponents of taxing the rich shifted over to making compensatory arguments based on either the fact that they really believed that or that it was the expedient thing to do at a time of war. You can see the same shift in patterns of debates elsewhere. If you go to small-town U.S. newspapers from the World War I era, we have astounding databases now, these small-town newspapers, and you can find references to this idea of conscripting wealth. So it was both an elite-level argument, but it was also something that struck a chord more broadly, very clearly, and it led us into a new era of progressive taxation with high tax rates on the rich. Now, that's an era that would last until after the wars through the 60s and the 70s, and then about 1980, things changed dramatically. Now, one reason, if you're from looking at the U.S. or the U.K., you might say that, of course, with the election of a Tory government in the U.K. in 1979 and a new kind of Republican president in the U.S. in 1980, we had partisan change that really shifted things. That's certainly a big part of it. But the movement we see away from progressive taxation over the last 40 years is not something that's specific to the U.S. and the U.K. So there are probably broader underlying structural things going on, and we think these structural things going on were also relevant in the U.S. and the U.K. context. So first of all, you might want to look at some of the arguments that have been made that are thrown out to see why over the last 40 years we're taxing the rich less heavily than we used to be. And that's what I'll talk about now in part three. So the first is globalization. We know that capital has become more mobile. We know that it's become harder in many ways to tax wealth because of that. You might think that what happened was, as capital became more mobile, governments were forced to lower top tax rates because otherwise they wouldn't have gotten anything. And they were forced into a situation of saying, well, if we tell you to pay a low rate, you're more likely to actually pay it rather than stocking your wealth in the Cayman Islands or doing something like that or finding a new way to avoid it because capital is becoming more mobile. In the book, we present systematic evidence that shows that that argument doesn't hold. We're not saying that the idea of capital mobility isn't a constraint for governments today, but what we do say is that if you want to look systematically across our 20 countries over the last 200 years, there's not much evidence that that's been the big factor over the last 40, at least, in leading to less taxation of the rich. The chief reason for that is if you look systematically and you say, well, which countries liberalized their capital accounts earlier than others, you will find if the capital mobility hypothesis was correct, you'd expect to see that those were the ones that shifted away from taxing the rich earlier, but it wasn't the case. In fact, the governments that liberalized capital controls earlier were no more likely to reduce taxes on the rich than were other governments. It was not systematically correlated in that way. Second possibility some people mentioned, well, maybe we just learned that having really high top tax rates of 70 or 80, even 90%, was just a bad idea because it constricted economic growth. And this, of course, is a counter-argument against taxing the rich that we have heard over the centuries. And the idea, it's a very plausible suggestion that, well, you should take into account the effect that this is going to have on the economy. Our role, we're political scientists, we're not economists, we're not taking in the book a stance on how big that effect is. But what we do suggest is that if that was really what was driving things post-1980, then, well, we might expect, for example, that in the countries that had bigger recessions or more of a slowdown in economic growth, then they'd move more quickly to cut top tax rates. There's no real correlation, in fact, between what happened in the 1970s in terms of your economy slowing down and the move towards lower taxes on the rich. It seems to be hard to find evidence for this actually driving government policy. A third possibility that people often talk about is captured democracy. Well, maybe what's really going on is that, in fact, the rich just have unequal influence, and they've gained more unequal influence in a country like the U.S. in particular because there's so much money in politics today in the U.S. and elsewhere. So if there's so much money in politics in the U.S. today, well, that could be true, but in fact, coming back to our original story, this movement away from taxing the rich has been a very general one. It's been something that happened on average across all of these 20 countries. And so if you're going to refer to captured democracy as a democracy being captured the rich, then you'd have to think about a theory and some ways of showing that more generally. You can't refer to specific features of the United States, such as the fact that in the U.S., campaign funding today is essentially unlimited by the rich, almost no legal limitations, because what's happened in the U.S. is the same thing that's happened in a country like Canada, where there's very little money in politics, and where up until recently campaigns have been publicly financed. For the same reason, you couldn't say that there's some specific reason to the U.K. that has made captured democracy and leading to a lack of higher taxes on the rich, because again, it's been a more general phenomenon. What we suggest in the book is that what happened was that by the 1970s, by the late 1970s, politicians on the left no longer had access to the same sort of wartime compensatory arguments that they once did. What happened was these arguments had been the most powerful element in the 1914 to 1945 era in driving up tax rates. And then from that time, from the 1950s and the 1960s, things sort of trucked along. In the 1950s, you can still find examples of these wartime compensatory arguments being made because in some cases people had to debate how to repay war debts. And one could say that those who didn't sacrifice should pay higher rates. But certainly by the 70s, if you look at the manifesto from the Labour Party, or if you look at the platform of the U.S. Democratic Party, what you see is a pleas for keeping top tax rates on the rich high, or even raising them in some instances. But the arguments that they make are saying simply, it's fair. They say it's fair, but without really saying why it's fair. Which to us, suggests that suddenly the left was deprived of the big wartime argument that had been so successful in generating these very high taxed top tax rates that we saw in the middle of the century. And there's one way in which I'll try to show you this. This is a graph that's going to use the evident data from the Google Ngrams tool. Google Ngrams is basically anything that's been vacuumed up in the Google Books database, where you can search for individual phrases, and you can see the frequency with which these phrases occurred over time, and the relative frequency relative to other things. So, focus only on the solid line. This is a graph showing the relative frequency of the term equality of sacrifice in the English language. It starts off in 1844 as a term first used by John Stuart Mill. When Mill talks about equality of sacrifice, he actually has thinking of equality of sacrifice as a synonym for ability to pay, that what we want to equalize is the sacrifice. Over time, however, in a wartime context, equality of sacrifice starts to get used in an entirely different way. It starts to get used in a compensatory way by saying, well, what we need is equality of sacrifice in the war effort such that people who are not serving at the front, who are not sacrificing in that way, or who are not having their labor conscripted, should somehow sacrifice in other ways as well, by paying higher tax rates. What happens, if you look at this graph, you can see there's this really remarkable increase in the frequency with which the phrase equality of sacrifices was used. It's used very heavily in World War I, even more heavily in World War II. And then, astoundingly, what happens after that is that right from 1945 on, we've been on a long, slow decline in the use of this phrase in the English language, to the extent which, this is 2004, if you were able to extend it today, it's almost non-existent. We think of the use of that phrase as a proxy for the disappearance of these compensatory wartime arguments over time. It's a way of showing with one picture something that you can see better if you had more time to read speeches and other things to see how the nature of the fairness arguments being made by people changed over time. So what happened was, I think if you looked at the things from the vantage point of 1980 or just before 1980, a lot of people on the left thought, well, the fairness-based argument battle for taxing the rich has been won. People understand that we should do that because of ability to pay. But the problem is the reason why there was ever a strong political majority in favor of taxing the rich was not just because some people believe in ability to pay, it's also because of these compensatory arguments that were made. And once those compensatory arguments can no longer be made in the same way, we were in a world where political entrepreneurs, if you want to call them that, like Reagan or Thatcher, can come around and say, well, no, maybe the fair thing is actually to tax everybody at the same rate or something more closely resembling the same rate. Maybe it's not fair to tax the rich at such high rates as had been happening previously. Okay. This is a graph which we think shows something about where U.S. voters are today. This is, again, like the others, not very well labeled. I'll walk you through it. Percent here refers to, we asked people in a nationally representative sample, a large nationally representative sample, what their preferred top marginal rate of income taxation was. That was something we did after explaining things about the structure of the income tax system and after also giving them opportunity to look at different income tax schedules and think about that. And then finally just asked them, okay, what do you think the top rate should be? And also, what do you think the rates at these other points should be? These points, these correspond more or less to the levels at which in the U.S. Income tax system today you would pay a higher rate. And this is the response showing a standard box and whisker plot where the big boxes represent half of the distribution and these whiskers represent the interquartile range. And what they suggest is that on average, if I showed you a graph with the actual U.S. income tax schedule today, it looks just about like this. So we may actually be in a world, at least in the U.S., where voters are getting more or less the tax rates that they want. And the reason why maybe they may be getting that is because compensatory wartime arguments no longer play, and they're not particularly convinced that there should be much higher rates. If you look at that, this is the top rate paid by those who earn more than $375,000 a year. Even the most extreme of the most extreme people only say that we should go to 70%, which is considerably lower than the post-war era. And the vast majority of people don't go anywhere near that. I think that's interesting when you think about it. Even Bernie Sanders suggested we should put the top marginal rate of income taxation up to what? 53%. That's certainly a lot higher than where it is today at 39.6%. But by historical standards, it's not particularly high when you think about what happened in the era between the two world wars. And I'm sure the Sanders campaign probably recognized that, well, there's actually probably not tremendous support for these extraordinarily high rates like we saw in earlier times. So if that's the case, then the final thing I want to do tonight is that if you're concerned about income inequality, this is a rather distressing picture because it's suggesting that there's not tremendous support in the U.S. electorate, at least, for having people taxed at much higher rates than are currently in place. If someone would like to fund us for a YouGov study of the U.K., we could do the same and see whether the same thing applies, but we don't know that for yet. We'll just have to infer it. So the final thing I want to do tonight is talk about what are the features that might shift today's debates with regard to taxing the rich. Well, first thing I want to emphasize something that I don't think is going to shift things, and that is that we shouldn't expect just because there's rising inequality alone that there's going to be greater political support for higher top tax rates. The reason for that is that if you believe in ability to pay as a criterion for fairness, it makes sense. Inequality goes up, the rich should be able to pay more. But there's a lot of people who don't think that ability to pay is the right criterion for fairness. There's a lot of people who believe in equal treatment. Many proponents of progressive taxation, if you're reading texts by even extremely smart people, much smarter people than us, say like Joe Stiglitz, I think what you'll find is they'll emphasize this aspect alone. Inequality is increasing, and therefore, because inequality is increasing, we need to tax the rich more heavily. As I said, I think what this does is it only convinces those who are already converted to the proposition that we should be taxing the rich more heavily. It doesn't convince people who adhere to other standards of fairness. Well, what can we do then? Well, one way would be to think about talking about areas where in the U.S. or the U.K. system today, there are many cases where the rich actually pay lower rates than everybody else. And so if you think about in the U.S. today, if you use data from the Internal Revenue Service, and you look at the effective, the actual rates that people end up paying after all deductions, exemptions, and things that Donald Trump and others have access to, then the higher you are in the top 1%, the richer you are, the lower is your average effective rate of tax. Well, this may be a big reason why, remember I just showed you a sample showing it looked like the American public doesn't support higher tax rates on the rich, but if you conducted a survey, as people have done in the U.S. public today, and said, do you think the tax system is biased in favor of the wealthy, they'll say yes. A vast majority of Democrats will say that, and even a large minority of Republicans will say the same. And the reason we think is that if you ask people what's biased about the system, it's not necessarily that the rates should be higher, it's that there are a lot of people who are avoiding taxes or using perfectly legal ways, or sometimes dubious ways, to avoid tax, to not even pay what you think they might be paying. And if you think about targeting these areas where the rich are paying actually less, and I think some of this has been done in the UK and people have found it politically expedient to make this argument, even on the conservative side, then this is the type of argument that both ability to pay and equal treatment adherents should agree on. Because equal treatment and ability to pay people don't agree on what the top statutory rate should be and whether it should be higher for people who are rich. But they certainly at least agree that the rich shouldn't be paying less than everybody else. Third possibility, use old compensatory arguments in a new era. Remember I spoke about the way in which in the 19th century people had made not a wartime compensatory argument but a peacetime compensatory argument. They'd made a peacetime compensatory argument of saying, well, we know there's a lot of indirect taxation going on. The burden of indirect taxation on common consumption goods is much higher on the poor and the middle class than it is on the rich, because the poor and the middle class consume a much larger fraction of their income. Well, we can make compensatory arguments of the sort today in a new peacetime context. And so, if you're thinking about the weight of value-added taxation, which has become very heavy in a lot of European countries, or sales taxes at the U.S. state level, because we don't have a VAT in the U.S., then arguments can be made that the burden of those is actually quite regressive, that the poor and the middle class end up paying higher rates on those taxes because they consume more of their income. And so then there's an argument for saying, well, this is why we need progressive taxation. We need a progressive income tax to compensate the effect of indirect regressive taxes. Again, to reestablish equal treatment. If they're being honest, this is something that both adherents of equal treatment and ability to pay should be able to agree on. Fourth and final thing I'll say tonight is that if we think about the big picture, the one thing I hope I may have convinced you of is something about understanding how beliefs about tax fairness work. First, that the very high tax rates of the mid-20th century were driven by an exceptional series of events, the nature of mass mobilization for war, the way in which that created new inequities in participation, creating possibilities for new compensatory arguments for taxing the rich, and that those days are unlikely to be repeated, or at least we hope, with respect to the war. So today, the public certainly wants a fairer tax system. If you ask surveys, you will see that people complain about the tax system being biased in favor of the rich. But that doesn't mean a return to the very high rates of the 1950s necessarily. It doesn't need much higher statutory rates. It may just mean getting the rich to actually pay the rates that are already on the book. And then the final thing, which I think is particularly important, is that when we talk about debates about taxing the rich, that we need to recognize that if you think about the electorate in the UK or the electorate in the US or the electorate elsewhere, that different people are going to adhere to different criteria of tax fairness. And that just because inequality is going up isn't going to convince everybody. It's going to convince the people who already believe in ability to pay rationale for taxing the rich, But that fact alone is not going to convince the equal treatment people. And ultimately, what you're going to need is an argument that's able to capture a strong majority of these people adhering to different fairness views. Because if you continue to simply say that we need to tax the rich more just because inequality is going up, then in a sense what you're doing is already preaching to the converted. And I'll stop there. Do I sit back down now? Do I sit back down now? Oh, okay, all right.
Well, we've got about three-quarters of an hour for questions and or comments. I was supposed to say something, and I was supposed to say something critical, and it's really very, very difficult to do. It was totally marvelous. I think the book itself is super persuasive as a book, which rather shocks me because I didn't used to think this sort of argument was the sort of argument one was allowed to make as a political scientist. I'll come up with one question to start with, and I'll have one in reserve in case.
Okay.
The question really is this, which is about the role of trade unions. Because there were exceptionally tight labor markets during the World Wars. And the trade unions, let's just take this country, the trade unions, which had really had pretty little role in government before the First World War, were brought in to the a member of the, essentially via the Labour Party, into the war cabinet. And the role of trade unions during both wars, think of Ernest Bevin in the Second World War, was absolutely central to making sure there was a huge amount of working class cooperation in factories where labour markets were super tight. 30% of the previous workforce had gone to fight the war. So one question which, as it were, seems to me to be important is, if you actually look at this overall graph of things tightening up, taxes rising during the First World War, and then remaining very high right through to the 1970s and then gradually coming down again, that's not a million miles away from a graph which you get of the percentage of unionization of the workforce. And what one might say would be that once unions had got really embedded in the government then gave unions a lot of what was called institutional compensation, enabling them to become much more institutionally embedded in the labour market after the First World War, and hence leading the unions into a position where they remained very powerful for a long time. Now, this is not at all a million miles away from the compensatory argument. But what I'd be adding to that argument or qualifying that argument would be by saying, to what extent was it the role of unions which was the primary mover rather than the compensatory argument itself? Now, let me just say in brackets after that, I would be persuaded by this argument, but the more I've been thinking about it, the more persuaded I am. So that you can take that as a very reasonable qualification of what I've just said.
Yeah, so I think that's it's a very important point that, as always, when you've written a book, you think about other things you could have said and that we could have said more about. Now, in some case, in the UK case, it fits perfectly. And some people have made this argument with respect just to the wartime context, that you need these people not to strike, they have more leverage. What doesn't quite work there for that argument is that in a lot of countries, including the UK, the tax increases don't really get, the big tax increases on the rich don't really come until after the war is over. Basically, what happens is countries borrow, and then the debate over taxing the rich happens in order to say, how will we repay this debt? The institutional argument you made, I think, is very useful. It takes us a step further in saying, well, it's not just that the unions have this influence during World War I, but they acquire additional institutional influence as a result of new patterns of organization. For the UK, I think that works. For the US and for France, it doesn't work very well. So the UK case, I think it's harder to disentangle. For other countries in our sample, I don't think that would work quite so well. But there is another way in which I think unions mattered a lot for this story. If you think about that, remember, this, I think, the conscription of wealth, as best we can tell, was an idea that first was produced by the TUC.
Very interesting.
Originally, I thought it was Sidney Webb, but then it looks like, I think, Sidney Webb just picked it up afterwards and saw this was a great argument. And then that's something that says something about the ability of unions and the fact that if you have large unions with large membership communicating, that allows for the construction of arguments about fairness that wouldn't be possible otherwise. The reason I scrolled back to this graph here is to show you something that might seem anomalous. That very high peak, that's for debates about equality of sacrifice in the US Congress in the early 1950s. That is because that was a period in which there was a debate about something where the AFL-CIO, the US equivalent of the TUC, was referring to the term equality of sacrifice. And if you know anything about the AFL-CIO and American unionization circa 1950, what you know, there were a lot more union members today, and what the members and the head of the AFL-CIO said mattered a lot. And it mattered in the sense that this was a space for constructing argument that could be heard, and heard by a lot of people. Now, think about what's happening in the U.S. today. You know that unionization is much lower than it once was. I was scrolling through my iPhone here, not to be rude to David, but because I wanted to look and give you an illustration of that fact, that that's not cut just the number of union people who are union members. It's also reduced the ability of union chiefs to communicate and to be heard. So if you think about this, Richard Trumka, who is the current head of the AFL-CIO, on Twitter has 46,000 followers. That's a lot. That's more than I have. If Twitter had been around in the 1950s, he would have had 10 million followers. And so that really says something about the role of unions in terms of pressuring, but also the role of unions in generating ideas and arguments, which I think is critical.
Well, open to questions.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. You'll take them.
Go on.
Working okay?
Yes.
There's one aspect of the discussion on taxation that has always amazed me, and I see it in the media the whole time, and that is that people focus the whole time on income and income taxes. Now, I start with the position that the rich are rich because they have wealth. A lot of assets are very lightly taxed for all sorts of reasons and because there are all sorts of dodges around that. So if you look at assets in the UK, a good way of getting wealthy in the last 25 years has been to sit in a farm or sit in a big house or sit on woodland or maybe have some shares in a fast-growing company, which isn't necessarily tracking the FTSE or whatever it happens to be. And if you look at the rises in those assets over the last 20, 25 years, they're typically of the order of 8-9% cumulative. And as I've suggested, for various reasons, they're often completely untaxed. So I put it to you that there's two categories of the rich. There are people who run the FTSE 100, and they take back their 1 to 5 million a year, and that all accumulates nicely. But if you've got 20 million tied up in land or a large house, you don't really care what income tax is because your wealth accumulation each year, probably untaxed, is far greater than what you're earning in the first place. After that very long preamble, can I say, to what extent did you take that into account?
No, it's a very important point, and it's one that I've spoken mostly about just the income tax here, but in the book, we really do treat the case of the income tax and the case of the inheritance tax in parallel. And a lot of the movements in inheritance taxation, you can see, have been driven at the same time by these wartime compensatory arguments and by the disappearance of these wartime compensatory arguments. There's also something else about the inheritance tax, though, which I think makes it possible for there to be so many exemptions and such a high limit and not a very high rate, is that if you look at the UK electorate or the US electorate, and you survey people and you ask them what they think about it, they don't think it's fair. Now, I think it would be fair, personally. I think, you know, it's the one of the most fundamental tools we have for dealing with an unequal distribution of wealth. But as I made with respect to point with respect to the book, I think there are different views, criteria for fairness, and there are some people who say, well, each person who's born with this, they didn't earn it. Why shouldn't they be taxed on the basis of that? Or why shouldn't the estate be taxed? It's the estate in the U.S., it's the inheritance here. But then there's another aversion, is to say, well, what if you think of families as these sort of long-run dynasties? Then why shouldn't you be able to pass on wealth to somebody else in the same way that you as an individual should be able to save wealth from one year to the next? I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying that that's an argument that is out there. And so, at least in the U.S. case, where I know the survey work the best, and I think we have more survey work on the inheritance tax for the U.S. and for the U.K., sometimes it's misinformation. People don't know how high the threshold is. They don't understand how few people pay this. But there's also an effect where even if people do know, even if they're told how high the threshold is, they're still not very favorable to the idea. There's something about inheritance taxation that seems to stick in their craw, to use the U.S. expression. And so if that's the case, then if you want to think about the idea that the distribution of wealth is becoming more and more unequal or might become more and more unequal, then that's problematic, because that means that there isn't tremendous popular support for one of the fundamental levers that we think could be used to deal with that.
Yes. Can you say who you are?
Hi, my name's Leon. Thank you very much for your talk. You mentioned about money and American politics not really distorting the debate on higher tax, and use Canada as an example. I don't think that's really gives a true picture of what's going on, because the people who are wealthy own the media, and therefore there is no debate allowed within that circuit. And also,
in the US or in Canada?
Both.
Okay.
And here in the UK. And more disturbingly, they also own the universities in America and here, like the London School of Economics, who is supported by an oil company. So they affect and distort the ability for any real debate happening regarding high rate tax. So I think when you say democracy has not really affected top rate tax, this is probably because we don't live in a democracy. And I think a good proof of living in a democracy would be the more tax of the rich would prove how healthy and how vibrant a democracy is. Would you agree with that last statement?
That might be true. I mean, I think the direction you're going in is partially I would agree with, and partially I think it poses problems. I would agree that in any society, the wealthy have more influence, democratic or not. But it's also the case that wealth is always very unequally distributed in any society. This was even true in the 1950s. So what you have then is, you described for me, is a fairly constant fact. If we went back to the 1950s and the 1960s in the UK and the US, we looked at the major press outlets, we wouldn't see that they were owned by the working classes or by the middle classes. We would still see that they were owned by the rich at the time as well. So that's a constant fact, and that's therefore it's not something that you can't use something that's constant to explain something that's very dramatically changed, which is this huge uptick in top rates in the early part of the 20th century, followed by a very large downtick in top rates at the end of the 20th century.
Good. Yes, I'm Dr. Keith Postler, affiliated to LSE and on the academic staff in management accounting at Birkbeck. Do you see, or could you comment on, the relationship between trusts and taxation?
In the U.S. context, I can comment on that. I don't know the data for the U.K. context. If you look at it's certain, and this was something that came up in the 2012 presidential campaign, that Mitt Romney had a lot of wealth screwed away in trusts. If you look at best estimates of the total amount of wealth held in trusts, it's actually a small percentage of total wealth. So it's certainly for the people who are able to avail themselves or who choose to avail themselves of that means of potentially avoiding inheritance or estate taxation, it's very important. But quantitatively, I don't think it's that critical. And one of the other elements that I think is useful in the book, we actually do have a section where we discuss how inheritance taxes actually do move wealth inequality over time. Whereas if the wealthy could always just find it no problem to have exemptions or to put their wealth in trust or to find any way of avoiding it, we wouldn't see that. But what we see is a pattern whereby as the top inheritance tax rate goes up, wealth inequality tends to subsequently go down. What's interesting is we don't see the opposite. We don't see that when inequality goes up, the top inheritance tax rate goes up as well, for the reasons I've tried to describe.
Professor?
Back
here. I'm here. Can I make a question?
Yep.
Hi there. I'm Adam. I'm a graduate student here at LSE. And I just want to follow on from what a couple of people were saying about inequality. You've given sort of reasons specific to our time about why higher inequality doesn't necessarily lead to higher tax rates. But putting aside contemporary concerns, why do you think that in a democracy, all things being equal, it doesn't automatically lead to more inequality, doesn't necessarily lead to higher rates of taxation? Is it, as one previous gentleman said, the media? Is it a problem of political systems, of education? And can we generalize about this, or is this very much a problem of specific problems of different nation states?
Yeah, I think it's going to. There are multiple responses to that, all of which probably carry some of the truth. I think there are cases where there is capture by the wealthy, and that's important. I'm not going to stand here to you today and say that the role of money in U.S. politics has had zero effect on preserving certain tax breaks for hedge fund managers, for example, or private equity people. But if you look at it, and the other one that's sometimes offered as well, people, ordinary voters just don't understand, I think that sometimes happens too. But I do think it's also the case, as we try to say in this book, is that people do really adhere to these norms of fairness, and these norms of fairness vary. And so as long as if everybody was an ability to pay type person and thought of the world that way, then as inequality went up, there would be a lot of popular support for saying, well, that's it, we have to raise the top tax rate. And the fact that it doesn't happen may mean that those other things such as capture are going on, but we think it also means that if you look at the actual arguments that people adhere to and the arguments that people make, there's a lot of popular support in some quarters for something like a flat tax system where everybody pays the same rate. And that's very clear in U.S. polling data over time. I think it's even clear from some segments of the U.K. electorate, although the survey evidence there is much, much more preliminary. I'm not saying that's a good thing, right? I'm just saying that's how I understand the way that the world works in part.
Professor, okay. I want to make you a question about taxation. I'm here. Can you see me?
Oh, there you are. Okay, sorry. It was the disembodied voice, yeah.
No, your book, the title of your book is Taxation the Rich. I work in a sport industry, and there has been a big case on Sunday Times in August because they said that a football agent based in Monaco is south of France, basically got a 30% sell-on fee to the sale of a player from an Italian club to Manchester United. That football agent got basically £35 million, and he went to his bank account in Monaco. So all the most rich people, basically, I'm talking about sport industry, maybe even other industry, they are based in Monaco in Europe. So they don't pay taxes. So I think it's an example of inequality and the indifference of the government.
Yeah, I think it also reflects that when the movement turns politically against taxing the rich so heavily, governments tend to exert, in some cases, less effort in terms of seeing that people don't avoid tax in ways such as that. You know, one of the best examples of this is, people always say today, well, governments can't do it, people can put their wealth elsewhere. If you read the memoirs of the head of the Inland Revenue from the 1950s, published in 1965, and we cite these in the book, he describes in very eloquent terms how they dealt with problems like this. So, for example, there was a problem with the income tax with retained earnings in family firms. If you own the company, then just don't pay yourself a salary, and it comes in terms of earnings. Well, what did the Inland Revenue do then? They just said, we're imputing this amount. This is the amount of income you probably, by our estimates, you would have earned if you played things normally and weren't trying to avoid, and therefore you owe tax, and that's it. So this comes down to the governments, when they want to do this, they actually can do this.
Yes.
You've actually almost just answered my question with your comments then. But you've tracked how tax rates kind of correlate to arguments of fairness. And I was wanting to know if you've also tracked how the amount of money government spends on stopping tax leakage, whether illegal leakage or changing loopholes, has also fluctuated in relation to the arguments of fairness.
Well, in the U.S., unfortunately, we're going backwards on that because, of course, the Republican Congress thinks that the IRS should be, the head of the IRS should be impeached and that they're against the whole idea. I don't know what the trend has been in the U.K. I think that's particularly problematic for inheritance taxation because inheritance taxation, historically, inheritance taxes actually predate income taxes in a lot of cases, and that is because they were initially seen as an easier way to tax people on administrative grounds. If you were trying to establish probate for an estate, then you'd want to go to the justice system to do that. You'd need to go to the justice system to do that. That meant that the tax authorities could sort of piggyback on inheritance tax. And if you read, again, the memoirs of the head of the Inland Revenue from the 50s, again in the UK, is precisely what he says. He says this was regarded at the time as something of a self-enforcing tax. I think what's happened since then is the variety of vehicles and means of disposing of wealth and putting it in ways where we don't even know where it is has multiplied. And so, in a sense, then what happens is that inheritance taxation has become probably much more difficult to collect precisely as a result of that. So things have flipped. It used to be initially circa 1900 or even 1950, it was easier to collect inheritance tax than income tax, and now we've gone in the opposite direction.
Good. Hi, I'm here. Hi.
Oh, yes, okay.
I'm Shai. I'm a graduate student here in LC. I wonder, what do you think about the connection between solidarity and the popularity of the compensatory arguments? So nowadays we're a much more individualistic society, and during the war there was a real reason for people to feel, well, we need to compensate, and this is might be the reason for the popularity of compensatory arguments. Mm. And the question is, even if we now go or choose a strategy to use more compensatory arguments, will it have the same effect as in the during the wars? Because then there was a real sense of need to be in solidarity with other citizens.
I think there's a lot to be said for wartime solidarity, but the thing about wartime solidarity is that also sort of implies that you should just pay, do your part sort of unconditionally, or as long as you think that others are doing their part as well. So that doesn't necessarily tilt you towards saying we should tax the rich more heavily. I mean, there's some Gallup polls from the U.S. from the 1940s and the 1950s that are really illustrative of that question. People were asked at various points in 1943, 1944, 45, and then after the war for different income levels, do you think that the taxes that you pay today are fair? And not surprisingly, in the time of war, people were more likely to say, a very high fraction of people said that their taxes were fair. But that was true of all income categories, right? So that's a thing where you could imagine that solidarity could mean everybody just pays a little bit more on the same rate, not necessarily a steeply more progressive system where the rich are paying more.
Jesus knows.
Hi, thank you for your talk. Luna Glucksberg from the International Inequalities Institute. I have a question about an argument that I've heard made from rich people and elite themselves, which I think is quite, they make it quite strongly, if not loudly, but I think underlines a lot of their thinking about this, which is there's not many of us, we pay already a disproportionate amount, that is what they say, and we don't use any of the services because they insulate to private education, private healthcare, private everything. And it's quite strong if you speak to them. And I think that is what then filters through the media and through all sorts of other outlets. And how do we confront this one? I mean, I personally and obviously don't share it, and I understand that the reason why they're able to have businesses in the first place is that the state supports the entire infrastructure that allows them to do so. But that is what they, how they see it.
Yes. So I think that's an argument that has a certain logic to it. It's not a fairness-based argument, is what I think is most important. There's no fairness criteria in there. What they are saying is true, and you'll hear this in the U.S. as well, is that it is true that even as the statutory and effective rates have come down, the top 1% is paying a larger fraction of total taxation than was the case. Now, that's because there are two things going on. They're paying lower rates, but inequality has shot up by much more. So that's not necessarily the relevant criterion to say that we should be equalizing the share that everybody... What matters is the rates that individual people pay. The second comment I'd refer to that is that refers to a sort of strict view of government that basically you should pay for what you get, which is could be one vision of fairness, but if they're saying that, then maybe they ought to say it more, maybe they ought to be called out on it a little bit more explicitly, is just saying, okay, is that what you think, that's what fairness is in a society, is just that it's like, you know, if you're going to a movie, you pay a ticket, and everybody pays the same fee. Is that what it is? In the end, that would lead to financing that would be much more regressive even than everybody paying the same rate. It could be a sort of lump sum payments for individual things. There are alternative ways in which you could say, well, someone who's very rich is actually still benefiting from a lot of things like basic security, basic property rights, and that the benefit they derive from that is actually larger precisely because they have more to lose in the case of...
Okay.
Hey, I'm Nuri. I'm a graduate student at LSE. And my question is, did you find in your survey about how the beliefs of a fair tax system look like, did you find any evidence on how the actual income influences this belief? So do rich people are more likely to be in favor of a flat tax system than people of low income are?
Yeah, so we actually, that's... If you want to buy it, that's in chapter 2 of the book. I'll describe it for you. We had a small survey that we looked at this question where we said, okay, let's consider the situation. The government's got to raise more money to do something, a certain amount, and you just have to do it. That's it. So it's not a question of whether the government should do it or not. But then the question is how people should be paid. Who should pay more? Should it be a flat tax or should it be a progressive tax? And we asked this to nationally representative sample in the U.S. of people of different income categories. And what we observed is, like you might expect, there was a lot of wealthier people saying, well, everybody should pay the same rate. And there were a lot of poorer people saying, no, the rich should pay more. But then there were a lot of people who actually made an argument that we would say is not congruent with their interests. There were a lot of poor people who say, no, we should have a flat rate. And there were a lot of rich people who said, no, we should actually have a progressive system. And then we asked them if to provide an open-ended response, well, why did you choose this particular thing? And what you can get out of that, we coded some of the results, and we saw that, again, the appearance of these fairness arguments that we referred to, people who weren't well off, but were nonetheless adhering to some sort of view of saying this is a fundamental in a democracy, treating people the same, and therefore we shouldn't tax wealthier people more. Whereas we found wealthier people in some cases saying, no, people who have more should be taxed more because they can afford it. So what I think that says in response to your question is a rather long-winded response to say that both things are out there. There's self-interest. We're not claiming that self-interest does not matter when it comes to taxation, but what we are claiming is that it's not only self-interest, and there are these fairness principles, these different fairness criteria that people would like to say that they adhere to.
Yes. Thank you. As I study economics, currently master's in economics here, I have read several papers on something that is called the optimal taxation theory.
Yes.
These are modern academic papers. And, well, of course, if you write a paper on optimal taxation theory, you have to have a clear idea of what is the optimal tax. And as I have read these articles, they usually refer to utilitarianism, for example, or the Rawlsian maximum, which are arguments from ethical systems that we would rather call consequentialist, mm-hmm. and they are very much opposed to those arguments that you recalled, which are basically equal treatment or equal sacrifice or equal treatment of wealth and labor. Do you think that these arguments resulting from ethical systems such as utilitarianism are more likely to be present in the public debate in the coming years?
Okay, so that's getting us a little bit deep in the weeds, but I think it's a good place to go because it's really fascinating and it says something about the intellectual evolution of these ideas about tax fairness and what's optimal. So you're correct in that those criteria that are used in optimal tax theory are criteria that are welfarist. They're not based on fairness, any sort of idea that people should be treated the same or something like that. It's strict saying, okay, we have a society out there with all these people positing what their utility functions look like and taking into account of the fact that if we tax people, they may work less, then how can we maximize social welfare? That's a laudable objective. I don't think it's the way that people in the public think about taxes. I think the way people think in the public about taxes is they adhere to these more standard and simple norms, and fairness norms, ultimately. There's a fascinating guy, a young economist at the Harvard Business School, Matt Weinzierl, who's working on precisely the kind of thing that we're doing, but in a theoretical way about thinking about whether people adhere more to the sort of fairness norms that we're talking about. He did his PhD at Harvard Econ. He did it working on optimal tax theory, so he knows the inside and the outside, but he's trying to sort of bring that a little bit more into thinking about how can we mesh with the way people actually, way people might actually think. And if you go back, it's really interesting. There was a point, I think Pigou is almost the turning point around 1990, with the principles of welfare economics is what, 1920? Something like that.
Yeah.
So if you see, he writes, and he's writing, and prior to him, there had been this argument, well, we should be taxing the rich at higher rates based on ability to pay, and thinking of that equality of sacrifice as a fairness principle. We want to have everyone make the same sacrifice. And then he says, well, you could do this based on either this fairness principle of equal sacrifice, or you could do this and think about justifying this based on a welfareist criterion of maximizing aggregate social welfare. And, you know, what's fascinating, if you read what he actually writes, he's sort of hesitant. He says, well, I guess we should just think of it in terms of welfare. And that's the way the entire discipline of economics subsequently went.
Yeah.
Good evening, David. John, economics teacher from Burntwood School. Could you tell us something about the selection of the 20 countries and perhaps make a comment on any notable exceptions?
The 20 countries, the exceptions, which are an interesting thing here, the really big exception is you could think that there's a big sample selection issue here, to the extent that we're only looking at cases where you have an income tax and where you have an inheritance tax. And a lot of countries, say in Latin America, haven't had these consistently, so that's sort of a first broad brush one. So if you think about, you know, the top incomes data, which is so important as it is, we know more about the inequality of countries that have done more to tax the rich than we do about other countries. So that is, in terms of Western Europe, we spent a lot of time, or the IRAs that we worked with spent a lot of time coming up with, we've basically got almost everybody in Western Europe. So I don't think there are any major exceptions there. It's Western Europe plus the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, elsewhere. So it's, if you want to think of it, the core of it is sort of could be Western Europe, and I don't think there's that much selection within that group or absence of countries that would bias. But it's more difficult when you think about, and we're not claiming this, but when we think about, well, are there other groups of countries for which we don't have data because there is no income tax? What drives people's sentiments in those conditions?
Okay.
Hi, my name is Nadeshda. I'm over here.
Yep. Hi. Yeah,
yep. So this might be a silly question, but I'm wondering if the modern-day compensatory argument could be the GFC. So arguing that it was the bankers' actions that caused a lot of the economic troubles that ordinary citizens are facing, so now they must compensate by paying higher taxes.
Yeah, and the Great Recession, in some sense, is the dog that didn't bark. Or that barked, at least in the UK, only for a little while and then stopped barking. In that there were these compensatory arguments that were made. There were arguments about having an extra levy. There were some things that were done. I think that was more present in the UK than in the US, because in the US, while everybody was unhappy about certain Wall Street banks triggering this, we have an economy where obviously a lot of rich people are in financial services, but there's also a lot of rich people in Silicon Valley or something like that. So it was harder to make it as an argument against or for taxing the rich more generally. In the UK, where you got an economy where a greater fraction of the top earners are in financial services, you could have seen that argument made. I think we could make it, but what you'd really have to think about the argument that was made in 1916 about a conscription of wealth. That is a really, really powerful phrase that is a really succinct way of summing up why we should do this. You'd need to think of something that's equally powerful and equally clear for the Great Recession. And I think for the Great Recession, well, a lot of us might think that, well, if the financial sector was responsible and to some extent they received bailouts that they should be compensated, then yeah. But it's a rather complex thing to explain to people or to even understand, and people disagree about what the exact causes of it were. So I'd just speculate that maybe that's one reason why we didn't see new, extremely powerful compensatory arguments coming out of the Great Recession.
Mike.
Thank you. It's Mike Savage from the Inequalities Institute. I was very interested in your discussion about how the First World War period is the crucial period for the takeoff of tax on the rich. And I just wonder if there's another factor which might be at work. Is I assume a lot of the top wealth income earners at this point are landlords earning money through rent, and whether it's the kind of anti-aristocratic, sort of anti-landed, unearned income notion, which is also playing into the fact that the public are actually quite receptive to, you know, why should these people earn huge rental bank loans for doing nothing other than owning land? And if that is true, that would be another big difference, I imagine, with the present day, when we have this image of the super rich who actually earn the money by income rather than by rental, possibly.
Yeah, no. I think there's a turn. This sort of the conscription of wealth idea feeds into a more generalized discourse against wealth. The other thing, and that's true in the UK, it's actually true in the US as well, where it tends to be more large industrial wealth and less sort of estates that have been inherited over time. The other aspect that we talk about in the book, but I didn't talk about tonight, of course, is that there's the issue of war profits. And war profits taxes plays a very large role in that. That's another very, very obvious compensatory argument, is that if large firms are actually profiting out of the war, then that's another reason for having high top tax rates. Yeah. And price controls, all sorts of management of the economy. Yeah.
Now, three more, and if you could keep it quite short.
Okay. Hi, I'm Nicolas. I am a graduate student here at LSE. You said that under the light that the poor have a higher marginal consumption, marginal propensity to consume, to consume, the value added tax is regressive. However, it is well known that it is one of the most easily collected taxes, and it also serves as a compensatory argument. So do you really think that the governments have a true incentive or a true incentive to reduce those taxes?
No, I think they need the VAT, right? So that's why it's been steadily creeping up over time as governments spend more, and governments spend more for good reasons to provide services and because populations are aging and so on. And so that's been a general OECD-wide phenomenon, with the notable exception, of course, of the U.S., where we don't have the only country that doesn't have a VAT. But I don't think that would lead to pressures to reduce the VAT. I think what it would lead to is, say, arguments like such as the one I sort of threw out on the table, is say, well, if you think about it, if the rich are paying, you know, they're consuming a larger, smaller fraction of their income, then the VAT does have a regressive incidence, and there's some doubt about it because you need to figure out whether the producers are passing on the cost of the VAT to the consumers or not. They might be eating it. But I would think it would lead to more pressure instead to potentially increase taxes on the rich. But again, that would be a compensatory argument that would be different from just saying there's inequality, therefore we need to tax the rich.
Hi, I'm a former student at the Inequalities Institute. How are you defining rich in this in the book, and how has the level of progressiveness of the overall tax system progressed over the same time period?
Yeah, that's a really important point. So what we define, and we do it in the first page of the book, is to say, look, this is a book about taxing the top 1% or even fractions within the top 1%. This is not a book about the politics of redistribution more generally. It's not a book that does a very good job or even tries to explain, say, what if you're not the 90th percentile as opposed to the 50th percentile. So we restrict ourselves to that because we think that this is even though it's not everything, it's still a fundamentally interesting question, is how much does a democratic society tax its richest citizens and why? But there's a lot of other work. So if you think of the great work that David has done with Torben Iversen over the years, it provides us with much more of a view of, say, how are people doing at the bottom relative to people at the middle, or people in the middle relative to those at the 90th percentile. We don't claim to be saying anything about that in our work. This is really a story about the top versus the rest, and the top being within the top 1% or higher.
Well, I'll finish in just one.
Okay.
when I was reading the book, I saw a television a film about Rudyard Kipling and King George V during the First World War, and Rudyard Kipling's son is killed in the First World War. There's a great drama about this. But then I thought, slightly mischievously, I actually go and look at what the data was on, as it were, deaths among officers versus deaths among soldiers. And very interesting, in the First World War, deaths among officers are, deaths among soldiers and non-commissioned officers are 10%, which is quite an amazing number, I'm afraid, when you add it up. Deaths among officers were 17%. And deaths among Etonians, take it Etonians were all officers, was 20%. So there's an interesting, so the idea of,
yes,
conversation. And if you look at the members of the cabinet, the Prime Minister Asquith lost a son, but the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Bonelaw, lost two sons, mm-hmm, killed during the First World War. So I'm not quite sure what the implications.
No, it's absolutely true. That's something
it just struck me as rather interesting.
We could have confronted them. It's interesting because Oxbridge is wiped out, right? I didn't know about Eton, but
Oxbridge, my point.
So and you know, so what happens then is that becomes, both in the U.S. and the U.K., that becomes a counter argument against taxing the rich more heavily, because the argument becomes saying, well, I'm not paying tax, I'm not on the battlefield, but my son is.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it boils down to, again, this is, comes back to that story of whether you think of families as being these sort of family dynasties and we're equalizing fairness across dynasties, or whether it comes down to individuals. And what the left tried to say was that, well, these are individuals, and so it doesn't matter if you're sending your son, if your son has died, you should be paying tax as well. Whereas on the right, people were saying, well, no, we're contributing, a member of our family is going, and we should be equalizing sacrifices across the families, not across individuals. And the right ends up losing that particular argument.
Okay, so let me start to bring this in. There's going to be a book signing outside for members of the audience who've been sufficiently generously stimulated by this absolutely, absolutely marvelous lecture. And all I can do is to thank you so, so much.
Well, thanks to all of you for coming.